Okay, Bradman, you are on. We can start talking about ventilation. Band is going. This is good. And I hope it's going. Yes. Okay, so we start with acute bronchitis. We're going to talk about ventilated disorders that affect ventilation. So why would acute bronchitis be a ventilation problem rather than a respiration or gas exchange problem? Yes, ma'am. Jill. Gas exchange doesn't take place in the bronchi. How perfect. Bronchitis is a mechanical issue, right? The bronchi would become congested, inflamed, which is acute bronchitis, right? Very simple. So try to differentiate the two. Think about the patho. This, think about your regular physiology of breathing. Gas exchange is going on in the alveoli. It's going on in the capillary membranes. Okay. Oxygen is picked up in the alveoli. Carbon dioxide is picked up in the capillary membranes. Something like bronchitis doesn't have anything to do with that, right? Which makes it a mechanical problem, which makes it a ventilation disorder. Okay? Bronchitis is common, right? It can be viral, bacterial, inflammatory. It's a response of bronchial tissues to pathogens. Generally begins with a non-productive cough. We've probably all had bronchitis, right? Yes, many of us. It's also considered a chronic pulmonary, obstructive pulmonary disease. A chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Because it can be chronic, constant inflammation of the bronchi. The lung parenchyme can be infectious. When would it be infectious versus non-infectious? When would bronchitis be infectious and when would it not be infectious? Yes. Correct. Absolutely perfect. Yeah. A smoker that has chronic bronchitis, COPD, is not, and coughing all the time, it's not going to be infectious. But you, who's had a virus, maybe it's gone into a secondary bacterial infection because you haven't taken care of yourself, now you have bronchitis, you're infectious. Got it? So it can be infectious or non-infectious. It can be community-acquired nosocomial. How's it going to be nosocomial? Post-operatively, just in the hospital, period. Someone with who's immunosuppressed, particularly whose respiratory system is suppressed, is a candidate for nosocomial bronchitis. Opportunistic. How would it happen to be opportunistic? In what case would bronchitis be opportunistic? You know this. Yeah, or how about you with the infection, the viral cold that then...
Oh, it turns into a secondary.
Yeah, it's usually bacteria. Not, doesn't have to be, but commonly is. All right, so got that? What else? Pneumonia. You've seen pneumonia, right? Tell me about your patient with pneumonia. Someone must have had a patient with pneumonia. Anybody? No pneumonia patients? Really?
I had pneumonia patient. He was just really
coughing
a lot.
He was
breath.
Couldn't catch his breath, coughing a lot. Yeah. Pain? Yeah. Just a pleural pain? Yes.
And I feel like every time he, I don't know if this is him, but every time he got up, his coughing smelled really worse.
Yeah. Coughing supposed to be even worse when it got up. Several different kinds of pneumonia. Acute bacterial pneumonia is an inflammatory response. Okay. Obviously, the causative agent is a bacteria. So you could have bronchitis, correct? And not say you have an opportunistic bronchitis. It continues on, goes down the respiratory tract into the lungs. And then that bacteria is in the lungs causing pneumonia. This could be acute bacterial pneumonia, all right, following a simple cold virus. We see a lot of this. Fever, chills. Why do we see rust-colored sputum? Why would that be? Blood, right? From the alveolar capillaries at eruption. Right, start coughing up a little blood. Pure pain. Crackles. Do you remember what the crackles are caused by? Yeah, well, elaborate on that. Yes, fluid, but exactly. What are the crackles? Think about the alveoli. Okay.
I was just
going to
say, before my friend asked, it sounded like he was just underwater.
He died of pneumonia? Yeah. He sounded like he was underwater. The crackles are when there's fluid, mucus, that builds up in the lungs, those alveoli are trying to open. Okay, so you're right. But it's that pop of them trying to open with the sound that gives us the crackles. And I hope you all have an opportunity to hear this. We're moving into pneumonia season, so you should get it in the next couple, 3 weeks in clinical. Have the opportunity to hear crackles. And they sound like crackling paper. That's what the breath sounds like. Exactly like that. Fine crackles, rails, dips in the cyanosis. Obviously, right? Why are they going to have trouble breathing? Why are they going to start turning blue? Gas exchange, right. Right, absolutely. Now we're having a respiration problem, aren't we? Because their lungs are deficient in taking in the oxygen that's needed for the body. So they're going to exhibit this in cyanosis. You're going to see it around the mouth. You're going to see some paleness. So in the hospital, we're going to give these people oxygen, aren't we? Yeah, you usually see them on some O2, generally. Pneumonia is one of the most common causes of death. It's what's very commonly listed on a death certificate. Do that many people just die of pneumonia? What's the deal here? Is it that prevalent? What do you think? Yeah, they're immune suppressed. So what finally kills them is pneumonia. But generally, there's been something else going on, and then the final straw is this pneumonia. Unfortunately, the scenario commonly goes like this. You've got a 9-year-old woman, goes out to get her mail, trips, falls, breaks her hips, comes into the hospital, and it's a slow decline, and she dies of pneumonia in 6 weeks. Okay, you see this over and over again. It's just kind of the last thing, and so it is termed the cause of death, where in reality, this 9-year-old lady was pretty depleted when she broke her hip and didn't have the resources to really rise to fight that, got pneumonia as a secondary, and died of pneumonia. So you commonly see pneumonia as a cause of death, but think deeper than that. Okay, yes, pneumonia was the thing that finally stopped the breathing. Therefore, it's on the death certificate. But there's generally a lot more to it. Crackles, what else are we going to see? Legionnaires. Anybody old enough to remember the Legionnaires outbreak? Do you remember? No? Maybe I'm the only one. I think I have it here when it was 1976. Okay, there was a convention of Legionnaires in the U.S. Where was it? Do we know where? It was somewhere. It wasn't here. I know that. I don't have it in my notes. So the American Legion had a conference. All of a sudden, you know, the American Legion guys, they're up there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. So all of a sudden they start dying, and no one can figure it out. They're dying in this hotel. And come to find out, there is this bacteria that's living in the air ducts of the hotel, in the water, in the air conditioning system. And it's killing all these legionnaires, all these American Legion members. And so they named it Legionnaires' disease and discovered it. And it's called Legionella pneumophila. It's a bacteria. Okay? Very cool. That lives in water. All right? That truly wasn't discovered until 1976. So that was kind of neat. So, and today, yeah, it's diagnosed. We see it in areas with standing water. And people die rather quick. Atypical pneumonia, primary atypical pneumonia, you're going to get all different kinds of pneumonia. It's if pneumonia is slightly different than the normal presentation of bacterial pneumonia, we're going to call it atypical. Most pneumonias we see are bacterial. Sometimes you'll get a viral, so the fever is not going to be quite as high. It's going to be more, it's going to be very high in a flu-like pneumonia. As headache, fever, malaise, aches, it comes on slower, right? So know that it can be viral as well. A virus can truly begin with a head cold and travel to become pneumonia. Okay, so it can be viral pneumonia. Yes? No, bacterial is more typical. Viral is considered an atypical pneumonia because they're more commonly bacterial-based, more commonly secondary opportunistic. But it doesn't mean that a virus can't travel down to the lower respiratory tract and cause pneumonia.
Did you say only viral
versus lower? I was mistaken, no. Viral would have a high fever from the beginning. No, I'm sorry. No. I'm mistaken. Bacteria is a higher grade fever in the beginning of the presentation. Thank you. Pneumocystic pneumonia. Anybody? What do we equate this to? Anybody have any idea? People with AIDS. Yes. Pneumocystic pneumonia. We commonly see it in people who are severely immunosuppressed, commonly with AIDS patients. And remember, one of the key characteristics of immunosuppression is to have a colonization of a bacteria that normally doesn't cause disease. And this is an example of pneumocystic pneumonia. Someone terribly immunosuppressed, it's common in the AIDS population. That we see pneumocystic pneumonia. And it could almost be a diagnostic tool. If you come up with pneumocystic pneumonia, you have some reason for being heavily immunosuppressed. Aspiration pneumonia. Any experience with this? Anybody think? I've got a great aspiration pneumonia story. Yes. Yeah. Yes, and that's from how do you get it? Exactly right. This is why we're so careful about our feedings. This is what we're worrying about with people with that have problems swallowing, is aspiration pneumonia. Did I tell you that story about the college student? Didn't I tell you? Oh, it's last semester. I was working in the hospital, and this college student was admitted. This was a university hospital. The college student was admitted. He kept going down, like, really fast. Within day two, he was in the ICU, going down, and we couldn't figure out what was going on with this guy. And he obviously had pneumonia, but nothing was treating it. Nothing would help. He died within a week, just like that. Well, tracing back, that Saturday night he had been at a party. He had had a stomach flu, all right, a viral stomach flu. Passed out, aspirated his own vomit, and was killed by the stomach virus. Yuck, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and killed him in a week. So yeah, and you know how virulent intestinal viruses can be. I mean, they come and go, and they hit you, and then you recover, and you're fine. Well, if they're in your lungs, you're not going to recover quite so quick. So he aspirated his own stomach content and died. So that's my most vivid aspiration and longing story. So it just shows you, yeah. So that's why we're so careful about people. You learned in your CPR class, turn people on the side, right? Don't ever let anybody aspirate stomach content. Food is one thing, that's bad enough. But never regurgitation. As we learned when we were talking about the gastric problems, we have a lot of subclinical infections living in our GI tract all the time that we're never aware of. And that could very well have been this young man's experience. He was doing fine, fighting it off. He may not have even known he wasn't feeling well, but it was enough to kill him when it got in his lungs. So this is my example of being very, very, very cautious with vomit, and always have people on your side if there's ever a question. Be very, very careful about any kind of stomach content being aspirated. And we do. We take good care. Let's see. Aspiration pneumonia. Yeah, complications, obviously. Anything could get infected along the upper GI tract. SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome. Okay. It's a lower respiratory illness of unknown etiology. That's pretty basic. If we don't know what it is, we're going to call it SARS. All right? Simply severe acute respiratory syndrome. It's thought to be viral, and it's spread by contact with respiratory secretions or direct contact with the infected person or contaminated objects. These are people that are going to be on contact precautions and respiratory precautions, and you're going to wear masks and gloves and the whole thing. The primary physiological process is development of hyaline membrane that interferes with gas exchange in the alveoli. Okay. Shortness of breath, dyspnea, hypoxemia, all that kind of thing. Occasionally, lungs get abscesses on them. And these may or may not be cancerous. That's for this course of this discussion, let's assume they're not. They could be localized areas of lung destruction or necrosis, and there can be some pus formation. Okay, so lung abscesses are not uncommon. You're going to have foul-smelling, purulent, blood-streaked sputum. Yeah, right, because it's an abscess on the lung. TB. Somebody cared for a TB patient last week. You did, yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
I have a little bit of anxiety, I guess, associated with the...
You have a lot of anxiety.
Well, especially with concerns with patients who are highly communicable.
Yeah.
So when I go to pick my patients, I don't gravitate towards those.
Well, it was unusual that Mia got to care for this patient. Generally, we don't care for TB patients because they're special fitted masks and special rooms, but you just happened to... She needed some help.
She just had to go to the bathroom. I was really nervous. I didn't know anything about the person, but, you know, once the fellow said, she just needs to go to the bathroom. And, it was kind of never in the verse, said, sure, because she was too busy and wanted to just put it off her belt. So I put on all the gear, and she was just fine. I mean, it wasn't any big deal. And later, when I was with the nurses, and they were filling in the next door, so we call it that transition between the nurses.
Change.
She didn't actually test positive this time for TB. She just had a history of it. So it was precautionary.
Right. And this is what we do. Anyone that's suspected or have a history, we'll put them in isolation and we'll take great care. So know that most of the time, they're not going to be infectious. But we, of course, err to the cautious side, particularly in a hospital, and we're very, very careful. TB is chronic, it's reoccurrent, and it's infectious. It generally affects the lungs, but TB can affect any organ. Okay? So TB is not limited to the lungs. And it is seen other places in the body. It's spread through droplet nuclei produced when the infectious person coughs, sneezes, speaks, sings, right? Inhalated bacteria then multiply. All right? So you breathe in the bacteria, it then multiplies in the lungs. And it's called a granuloma lesion forms. All right. Now, this then becomes a tubercle. The granuloma lesion dies off, and you're left with kind of a hard lesion in the lungs. And it becomes necrotic, okay? So you have this almost like a hole, a lesion in the lung that doesn't go away. That's why you can see TB on lung x-rays forever. It's always there. You'll have these lesions, the tubers, from the tubers that are formed. Hence, tuberculosis, because it forms these tubers in the lungs that become necrotic. Let's see. Scar tissue develops around the tubercle, and it walls off the bacilli. So that's part of our body's defense mechanism against the invasion of the tuberculosis, is that it walls it off. What else? Fatigue, weight loss, anorexia, low-grade afternoon fever. Interesting, huh? Because tuberculosis is chronic. It stays with you. Dry cough, it can become prurient. What about anthrax? Anybody know anything about anthrax?
I'm not sure what it is.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I didn't have that in my notes. Cowboys have to be careful, all right? It's also a spore-forming bacteria, and it's thought to be a potential bioweapon, okay, in terrorism. The spores can be in aerosolized, basically, so they can be, like, just put into the air. And then they're inhaled into lungs. Transmission is by person to person of inhaled anthrax. That does not occur. The spores come and then we inhale it, but person to person transmission doesn't happen, which is kind of weird. You have to get it from the bacteria in the air that exists, which is kind of strange. Flu-like systems, dry cough, dyspnea, stridor, cyanosis, lymph nodes enlargement. Eventual death can result from hemorrhagic hemorrhage. Yeah.
I have a question about TB.
Yes.
You said it can affect some
lungs, so it would. Yes, it would. It has the tubers that then are walled off.
Would it just spread in the body? Because I know it can.
Mm-hmm. It can spread in the body. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
It walls it off, but it doesn't go away completely.
Okay, so the
tubers can... Yes, exactly. As well as some that aren't. But I don't think it's ever completely eradicated. So it's still there. And, yeah, you have these holes in the next one. Yeah.
Isn't it with... It can remain active for a really long time.
For
life, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So at times of immune suppression, it would again come out. Okay? Yeah? Which is why we're so very, very careful with patients that have had it and have a history, just for that reason. Because people who are immune suppressed with a history of TB, what's going to happen? In the hospital, there's a big chance of it coming back, which is why if you have a history of reactivity, maybe that's it, just because of that. I don't know if it can ever be eradicated, frankly. I don't know if it can ever be. I can say it's absolutely cured. I don't know. That's something we should ask a community health nurse. I just know in the hospital we're always very careful. It's great, you know quite a bit about it.
Well, they did vaccinations for it in the
Yeah, that's another good point. As nurses, you will be required to, well, as nursing students, have TB tests annually, right?
Mm-hmm.
After years and years, you may very well test positive simply from the tests.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's okay. You'll just move to chest x-rays.
Because it's not blood anyway.
I don't know what it is, frankly. That would be a good clinical thing to find out. That would be a wonderful... evidence-based thing. I don't know. It would be simple enough to look up what exactly is the test. Is it attenuated? Is it? But whatever it is, over years and years and years of getting tested, you can test positive. Yes.
I tested positive for a skin test, and the skin test came back negative.
Mm-hmm.
And they said we can't do chest X-ray. We have to do
the
blood work.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the newer,
the new deal.
They do blood work now. Oh, interesting. And that wouldn't accept that. So now every year you've got to go through the whole thing. You may very well. So don't be like me and have your TB test two days before it expires. You're going to have a whole month. You have a test and then, well, okay. Yeah. I don't know. I've never taken a blood test. Is that true?
Yeah. Because I've always done the blood test. And I didn't have to take the TB, but they had issues and I had to.
Okay, so when there are issues, they give you the blood test. Okay. And then not the x-ray either. They go straight to the blood.
No, I've always taken the blood test.
Ah, very interesting. Thank you. So now we know. Is that right for you too?
I asked the doctor yesterday about
that. Oh, excellent. Good. Now we have
it. I'm one of those people who are vaccinated and who's always positive.
Right. Right, that's what I thought. That's what I thought it was, but
yeah,
no.
Yeah, but now, like, the QuantiFERON is actually detecting the TB in the blood. So it's a cheaper way to get the X-ray. But the TB was cheaper than the blood work. So we've been trying to use TB, but now I think they're going more for the...
All right, up to date. Now we know. Thank you so much. The word is that, no, not a chest X-ray. I was... last year's news, and now we do blood work because it's cheaper. Okay, so know that, but bottom line is, after years of having the injectable TB test, you may test positive, and then have the blood work done. Thank you. Okay, and we're talking about anthrax now. Got it? Anthrax. We mostly think about it as a bioterrorist weapon, right? That's what we think. Septic shock, meningitis kills us. What about histoplasmosis? Anybody with experience with histoplasmosis? It's kind of cool. It mimics TB. We don't see it much on the West Coast. We see it quite a bit on the East Coast, in the Midwest. It has to do with people who take care of birds, particularly pigeons. Pigeons harbor histoplasmosis. Yeah, kind of weird, huh? It's a fungal lung infection. It's the most common fungal lung infection in the U.S., the organism is found in the soil. It's linked to exposure to bird droppings and to bats. Okay. Then, huh? Histoplasmosis infections develop into latent asymptomatic disease or acute primary. So it's kind of like tuberculosis in that you can have an acute primary, and then it's asymptomatic. It's chronic, progressive, usually seen in older adults. But what's interesting about histoplasmosis is that on an X-ray, it can mimic tuberculosis. So you may have someone say, no, I don't have TB, I have histoplasmosis. So then they'll do all sorts of blood work to confirm that it is histoplasmosis and not TB. Because the fungal, the way the fungus grows in the lungs on the X-ray can look very much like TB. So that's truly why we bring it to up. Let's not talk about this, or blastomyosis, or aspergillus, okay? But we will talk about pleuritis, all right? Am I clear? Cross those out. We're good crossing out these three. Four. Two, three, we're on to pleuritis. Got it? Trying to make it easier for you. You're welcome. Pleuritis, inflammation of the pleural. I'm trying to get things that you're going to see, you know? So anything I haven't seen in practice, I'm not going to tell you. Very simple. And watch, you're going to see him as soon as I'm done with the lecture, right? Okay, pleuritis, inflammation of the pleural. Pleura. Okay. Produced by characteristic unilateral, well-localized, sharp, or stabbing pain. It's not uncommon for someone with pleuritis to think they're having a heart attack. It's very painful. It occurs secondary to another process, such as a viral respiratory illness, pneumonia, or rib injury. Okay. The chief manifestation of pleurisy is pain. Obviously, it's going to be agitated by coughing, breathing, any kind of lung movement. So people tend to breathe shallow, as they do with pneumonia. They tend to breathe really shallow in the top part of their lungs, to reduce the chest wall movement, thereby the pain. Okay, got it? So this is a differential diagnosis for an MI. This is why we talk about it. How about pleural effusion? Excess fluid in the pleural space is pleural effusion. People with heart disease, liver renal disease, connective tissue disorders, anything. The pleural fluid can be transudate or exudate. Okay. Let's see. What else about it? I guess that's about it. Manifestations, obviously you can have trouble breathing, pain, diminished breath sounds, dull percussion. Dull percussion. So if you're percussing, why is it going to be dull? Because what? There's fluid, right. So when you're listening to breath sounds and you're hearing crackles, let's say you go, let's see this pneumonia patient, and then you don't hear anything as you go down, is that good or bad? Why? What's that called? That you have in the basis if you're not hearing anything? It's consolidation, right? Then the lung is consolidated, there's no movement of air. And that would be at a latent stage pneumonia. You get the crackles, and then you're hearing nothing, which means there's no air movement. So think about that. Right. And pleural fluid, the same pleural effusion, you're going to have the same kind of thing. If you don't hear anything, that's when it's severe. Right? We're great, aren't we? And pleural effusion can be a symptom of pneumonia. Atelectasis, all this. Right. So you're getting fluid in the lungs, pleural effusion. Obviously, dull percussion tone. So if you're percussing, you're going to hear it dull. Lungs are supposed to be hollow, right? You can hear sound can move through. You're right. Yeah, if you're getting a dull sound, it's solid. This is dull, right? My chest is hollow sounding. So it's, you can hear it. I don't know about you guys, it's really fun to practice your percussing on walls. Looking for studs? Get really good. You'll never find a stud finder again. You go with the drywall walls, and you find it looks really well. No, they're 18 inches apart. Studs? Six? Oh, no. Yeah, they're like 18. Right, then you can guess. But it's great, so you can start. It's a wonderful way to practice. Okay. Pneumothorax. You know a lot about pneumothoraxes from the homework, right? Yeah. Can be spontaneous. It could be caused by a penetrating trauma. It can be iatrogenic. How can it be iatrogenic? In what way would a pneumothorax be iatrogenic? Any guesses? Yes. Ooh. Yeah. All sorts of problems with ventilation can cause pneumothorax. Not at all uncommon. A puncture, laceration of the visceral pleura during central line placement is another. A couple of you have seen central line placements, right?
Yeah, you said that. We were outside the door, like, people with pneumothorax, and I didn't understand why that was. They're replacing central line, so it's just too close to the lungs.
And they can puncture. Yeah. Can result from puncture or laceration of the visceral pleura. So, yeah, you don't want to go into the lungs. You'll cause a pneumothorax if you puncture that viscera. Thoracentesis or a lung biopsy. Anytime you're dealing with the lungs, you are at risk of puncturing the pleura or near the lungs, like with a central lung placement. So, and that's going to cause a pneumothorax. So iatrogenic pneumothoraxes are not at all uncommon. Let's see. Manifestations are similar to the spontaneous pneumothorax or the trauma pneumothorax that you worked on this week. Shortness of breath, the whole thing. Increased heart rate, obviously, right? Asymmetrical chest wall movement, yeah. And diminished breath sounds, okay? Traumatic pneumothorax, same kind of thing. Tension pneumothorax is like a pneumothorax. You have presence of hypotension. You're going to see extended neck veins too. And you're also going to be able to see the trachea. It's displaced to the unaffected side. All right. So in a tension pneumothorax, look for displacement of the trachea. It develops when the injury to the chest wall or lungs allows air to enter the pleural space but prevents it from escaping. This is when the air is going in. So the air is going in, you're going to push the trachea the other way, right? To the unaffected side. So it's kind of paradoxical. It's going to go the other way. It's going to push it to the side that's not affected. So it's not going to fall in on the side that's affected. It's going to be pushed because the air comes in and pushes towards the other side. Got that? It's a tension pneumothorax, so it's going to be opposite because the air is trapped inside. Hence the tension in the lung pushing that way. Got it? So it's a little different. Let's see, and distension neck veins, displacement trachea, and shock. Let's see, tension pneumothorax. Let's see, hemothorax, a collection of blood in the pleural space. Usual result of chest trauma, surgery, diagnostic procedures, again, can be iatrogenic. Same kind of thing. Trauma, chest injury causing the is the leading cause of death from trauma. That makes sense, right? What do we always say? People need, got to breathe. Got to be able to keep the oxygen. Injuries can be minor, with little effect on the respiratory status, or trauma can be severe and fatal to the chest or lungs. Obviously, rapid assessment is crucial. Rib fractures. Anybody had a rib fracture? Any of you softball players? No rib fractures on them? No? Oh, you're not the softball player.
Oh, well, I did the softball
player. I thought you did. No rib fractures on them. Ever got hit? Matt?
I think I have one. I don't know.
Yeah, you thought you had a broken wrist, right? No, yeah. Definitely. You probably did if you thought you had one. You probably did. What did it feel like?
When I was like a deep inhalation.
Pain?
I feel a little bit of soreness.
Pain on in inspiration, sounds good. Okay. Coughing, diminished breath sounds. Bruising over the fracture?
Yeah, a little bit bruising.
Crepitus, what's that? Cracking?
Yeah. I think I had a pretty mild fracture.
Mild fracture.
A little
They're generally well tolerated, heals rapidly in young, previously healthy adults. So, probably exactly what happened. Sometimes they can happen from pre-existing conditions like pneumonia. Atelectasis says people are coughing so much they can. Old frail people can actually break ribs. When else do we tend to break ribs?
CPR.
Have you ever seen CPR with cracking ribs? Cracking sternum. It's not nice. You've dealt with your jury population. Can you imagine some of those people doing CPR? Rib fractures are extremely common after CPR. If they survive, then they're left with a rib fracture. It's pretty scary. I remember, I've only been called to do CPR in an emergency once, because usually in hospitals there's these CPR teams that come in. Most often, but I was in a small place, so I was doing the CPR, and I remember just thinking, oh, I can't push right, I'm going to break his ribs. You know, I was really, really conscious of, you know, how far I could push, because this guy's ribs were like going. They press down an older person really. God, that's enough elasticity, you know. So it's just, you're thinking, how far can I push to get that 2 inches you're supposed to go down and not just pray that there's not much elasticity in the bone so you won't crack it. And I remember thinking, I didn't break any. But I was just really nervous about it because it commonly, and you see in the hospitals, I don't know if you've seen a code, but you see that they ask these big, the transport team comes and does CPR. So here are these guys that, you know, often they're big, burly guys. Sometimes they're not, but, you know, you kind of think of them as that. They're the strong guys who can do CPR for a while. So they're coming in and they're, without maybe the training or the finesse that you and I would have in that situation. So, yeah, it's not at all uncommon to be in a code and hear cracking ribs. It's scary.
But if you want to practice on friends, like, I do massage.
Mm-hmm.
No, I'm not talking about CPR. Actually feel similar to the ribs moving a lot. You can put a lot of pressure on the ribs.
That's good to hear.
Can you? And you can actually, like, I could show you on body, you can actually push ribs in quite a bit. And it feels kind of good.
Really?
Right?
That's good to hear.
Yeah. So
but these are young, healthy people as well. Really? Are more brittle bones? Oh, that's good to hear.
My fear is that the ribs can really, really fight a bit. And I haven't done this here on anybody, but I'm just saying
yeah.
If you want to get a little more relaxed, so that you can actually, like, work on a friend.
That's an excellent idea.
And from both sides, like the ribs or chevrons, just come down and push.
And it can take quite a bit of pressure, huh?
It can take quite a bit of pressure. I was surprised that there's fun.
Yeah, I am too, because that was just so much my concern, and I didn't hurt them on
yours.
Well, then we have the same outcome from two different approaches, that the ribs are a lot stronger than you think. Yeah, that's good. Good to know. Well, then why do we hear them cracking so much then? Just poor technique, you think? Or
I don't know.
Just too much force?
Just too much force. Yeah. Also, but you think about the
adrenaline
versus the...
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
You know, and
yeah.
Also maybe the placement of the hands
and the strength
versus the size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be. I agree. And the lack of education, you know, that not really being as careful as maybe a nurse would. Yeah. Right. You would go and confirm them.
Yeah.
You'd make sure. Yeah, you wouldn't. No. That there's a real strong DNR. No. Flail chest is a bit interesting. It results from multiple rib fractures. Two or more consecutive rib fractures in multiple places. All right? So you've got ribs fractured in several places. And that impair chest wall stabilization and normal chest wall function. All right? Frail chest segment is sucked inward. Okay? So this time the pieces that are broken are sucked inward during intonation and move outward during exhalation. This is known as paradoxal movement. So normally when we move in, right, everything goes down. Okay, this is, it gets smaller. Okay. Now, this is opposite, so it's going to be paradoxal. See if I have any, no, nothing about it. Maybe your book has a picture. I'd really like to see a picture. The frail segment is sucked in during intonation. So rather than when you inhale, rather than expanding, it's sucked in. So you see paradoxal movement of the chest during inhalation. Rather than expanding, the chest gets smaller during frail chest because of all the cracks in the bone and they fall in. Very interesting. So frail chest. You would see it in the ED. It's not an uncommon trauma injury, and you would read about it and see this paradoxal movement in your patient that you then saw on the med-surg floor. Pulmonary contusion. Anybody had a pulmonary contusion? Just like a bruised lung? No? No pulmonary contusion? Blunt chest trauma can occur unilaterally or bilaterally. And pulmonary contusion, alveoli and arterial rupture. So it's like a bruise on the lung. They cause alveoli hemorrhaging and edema. So if you were hit in the ribs with a softball, this is what you might see. Shortness of breath, redness, that kind of thing. Okay. Smoke inhalation. Carbon monoxide poisoning, right? Headaches, dizziness. This is interesting. The skin gets a cherry red color. Yes. Oh, please, yes. Yes. Oh, that would be the one of the manifestations of it. The contusion actually is just a bruise. But yes, if something hit the lungs that hard that it caused a bruise, most of the time it would get the air knocked out of you. But let's say you fell flat, that would get the air knocked out of you too, would be a contusion. Okay, but probably depending on where it was, it would force air out. And if something hit, because that's more of a blunt trauma somewhere, like a baseball. Or some blunt instrument causing a bruise. Got it? Smoke inhalation. Any experience here? Anybody been in a fire? Okay, for smoke inhalation people? I never have. I haven't. You guys were in the burn ward, right? Some of you were in the burn? Who was? Yeah. Any smoke inhalation people there? No, it just burned. Okay. Cherry red color to the skin. I've never seen this, but that is the characteristic manifestation is that cherry red color. So know that. That's classic. Visual disturbances, nausea, obviously dizziness. You'd expect that.
That's really bad.
Yeah, apparently. And that's what the photos show. But I have no personal experience with it. But I think it's something pretty basic that we should probably be aware of. You might see an NCLEX or somewhere. Smoke inhalation, that chill red color, is apparently very common. And I've never dealt with smoke inhalation patients, so I really can't speak to it. Just tell you that's what I've read as well. Carbon monoxide poisoning is obviously what smoke inhalation is, right? So you may get irritability, hallucinations, hypotension, seizures, even a coma. Near drowning. Okay. What happens with near drowning? Asphyxiation and aspiration. All right. Are the primary problems associated with drowning and near drowning? So a dry drowning occurs when the victims do not aspirate water, but a laryngeal spasm causes asphyxia. So a dry drowning would be the larynx spasms, and so they basically drown because they can't get any air. Water drowning, wet drowning would be when they're taking in water, obviously. But apparently there's something called a dry drowning that has to do with laryngeal spasms that cause asphyxia. Got it. Loss of consciousness can occur within 3 to 5 minutes of total immersion. Circulatory impairment, brain injury, brain death can occur in 5 to 10 minutes. Yet, we hear about those children that were underwater for 20 minutes and survived, right? Sometimes amazing things happen, particularly in pediatrics, or people in the cold, cold water, where everything is just shut down to such a point. But in general, brain death is like 5 to 10 minutes, in general. There are all these odd situations, but in general, that's what you can think of. Survival can be prolonged if the water is very cold. What else? Water aspiration can cause delayed death from near drowning. That's interesting. So if it aspirates in water, cause delayed death. There's some difference between salt water and fresh water. We're not going to go into that. Lung cancer. We talked a little bit about lung cancer when we talked about cancer. You remember it, right? Lesions in the lungs, weight loss, all the typical cancer symptoms, wheezing, shortness of breath, everything you would think of if the lungs were not working efficiently because of a tumor inside. You're going to, if something's growing in your lungs, you're going to decrease the surface area of the alveoli, therefore having the oxygen consumption, the respiration is going to be impaired. Why do we see clubbing of fingers and toes? See this in COPD patients as well. Right, lack of oxygen, so this is what you get. This is a manifestation of peripheral oxygen depletion. Okay. All right, this is where we said we'd stop, right? That's my understanding, that it is kind of, I've never seen anybody go back. It is a manifestation that tends to continue. I also don't, I can't think of a time when I've seen a person get better either. From a substantial respiratory illness. It's so bad that there was clubbing that it would go backwards either. In my experience, no. Okay, I think you guys would like a break, right? Yeah. Very good, here we go. It's working. Okay, this. So our first thing I want to talk about in regards to gas exchange is asthma. Anybody have any experience with asthma? All right. Tell us about asthma. Yeah.
Oh, my. I'm under steroids and
tell us about your medication regime.
I have
about the steroids. What is it? What do they do? Okay, tell me how you use those so that people understand why you have both drugs and why do you need them both.
One steroid is for just to prevent future asthma attacks.
The steroids are an anti-inflammatory, right? We know that. Steroids, the corticosteroids are anti-inflammatories. So this makes sense for an asthma patient, doesn't it? Because what causes the asthma? The inflammatory reaction, and so then air can't get out, right? You can't expire air. Correct. And so you're taking that all the time, right, to keep the inflammation down. And then what do you use the albuterol for?
For
for exacerbations, right? Yeah. So that's a quick release of albuterol. And what does the albuterol do, Dina? Relaxes the airways, yeah. Opens the bronchi. Okay, so there's, we really often, and this is, you're so typical, thank you very much. You're absolutely perfect for an explanation. Commonly, asthmatics will have at least two drugs, an anti-inflammatory, commonly a steroid, that reduces the inflammation in the bronchi, as well as a metered dose inhaler, right? Commonly albuterol, correct? And how do you take that metered dose inhaler? Do you ever do it ahead of time? Do you ever use a, I'll just fire all sorts of questions at you. A flow meter? Will you?
I have a flow meter at home, but I just, like, I have my inhaler right now. And I just take it, shake it first with the aerosol.
Uh-huh.
And I just puff two puffs.
Two puffs. And do you put it to your mouth, or do you?
I put it in my mouth, and once I push it, I inhale. Do the inhaler, and I hold it for like 6 seconds until I can. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, I was talking about something else. What you're referring to is a spacer. And there's also something that can judge the air capacity. Have you ever had one of those, a flow meter? So you can, I think that's what they're, maybe they're not called a flow meter. It's when, have you ever seen this? Your children have them a lot, and you can test the lung capacity by breathing into this little thing, okay, breathing out into it. And it will show the child, well, children commonly use it, anybody could, how much air they are able to take in. It's great for children before they're going out to play in the field, going into soccer practice, whatever. They can see if they need to take some albuterol before they go out. Do you ever do that? Do you ever pre-medicate yourself?
No.
For running or?
Oh, for running, yes.
Yeah. So then they can pre-medicate so that they can see, oh, yeah, I'm only at half capacity right now. I'm going to go play soccer. I better take a little more. So what kind of asthma do you have? Do you know? Is it exacerbated by exercise?
I've been having asthma
since I was a kid. Oh, this forever.
Yeah, I have forever.
What makes it worse?
Weather.
Interesting. Hot weather. Okay.
Allergies.
Mm-hmm. Pollen. Typical triggers. Somebody else that was an asthma person too. Yeah. Does that sound typical? Are you the same?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, allergens are a common trigger. Now, are you on a steroid as well? Okay. People that have asthma attacks once, twice a month, commonly then we move into steroids so that they have a level of anti-inflammatories. Many people can get by, which is the meter dose inhaler, the albuterol. Do you use it ahead of time ever, or just wait until you're... How about post-infection? That's another common time, after respiratory, upper respiratory infection. That makes all sorts of sense, doesn't it? When there's already the inflammation working, asthmatics commonly, that's another typical problem. Were you a childhood asthmatic as well?
Mm-hmm.
The most common, it's one of the most, I don't know if it's the most, chronic, I think it is, the most chronic childhood disease, asthma. Many people are diagnosed in childhood. Not always. It's not uncommon. There's an adult diagnosis, particularly today with all the poor air quality that we have. So asthma is a chronic inflammatory disorder of the airways, characterized by how do you present? What are your manifestations?
Wheezing.
You do wheeze. And explain what a wheeze is. What is a wheeze? Can you do a wheeze?
Basically, when I breathe in, after I breathe in, there's like a little sound that I can hear and I can feel it.
Yeah, because of the constricted bronchi, it's like this little whistling almost, right? It's like that. Because of the constriction, so the air cannot pass through, so it makes like a whistle, almost like a whistle, right? Anyways, you can hear. Pain? But any other manifestations?
Pain in
your back. Interesting. What's that caused by? Is that lung too somehow?
Every time I'm having pains, it's my back.
Interesting. Okay. More of a pressure is what people call it. Pressure? Yeah, is a common manifestation. Okay, interesting. Great. Thank you, ladies. Wheezing, breathlessness, chest tightness, coughing. Are you coughing asthmatics or just wheezing?
Mm-hmm.
Coughing. Please don't think that you have to wheeze to have asthma. You don't have to have that kind of, no. Coughing asthmatics are equally as many coughing asthmatics. When I was a nursing student, I was doing my senior project on, I was working with a school nurse and doing a whole asthma program for a rural school, right? And here's my Patrick, you know, the music major. At that point, he was like 4, okay? So he's having trouble breathing, and I'm thinking he just has this cold that won't go away. And I'm, you know, busy, and I'm not thinking anything of it. And I'm just, you know, I'm doing all this asthma work, and I'm thinking, boy, you know, he really sounds like he has asthma. Then I'm thinking, no, I'm not going to be one of those nursing students whose family and who gets everything that they're reading about. He's fine. So then one morning he comes in, and he's like breathing, like, and his heart rate's like, I don't know, 200 or something. Oh my God. So I rush into to the pediatrician. He says, he has severe asthma. I went, you're kidding me. So he had an oxygen sat of like 80 or whatever, and it's fine now. But yeah, it can creep up on you. And I know that you're nursing students, you're thinking, I'm not going to fall into that, you know, and think that my kid or I have everything that, well, here's an example where I didn't use my knowledge correctly and almost killed my son. He was fine now. And who has outgrown his asthma, by the way? Yes.
I actually had something like that when I was sitting
with
my daughter.
Did you?
I had these terrible coughing fits and I didn't know what was going on. It was like allergy season. And so I'm like, I don't know, being pregnant made it worse or something like that, but they made me
more. Okay, why would being pregnant make it worse? Yeah, they don't have the room. What else?
Yeah.
You don't have any air. Yeah, you don't have any air. And the oxygen you have is like, has to do double work. So that's interesting. I've never heard of pregnancy-induced asthma. And you have it now? Mm-hmm. Now you're fine. Interesting. That's the first case of pregnancy-induced asthma. So now we have a whole other category, right?
Mm-hmm.
Pregnancy-induced asthma. All right. And nursing student asthma and all sorts of things. Okay, episodes are relatively brief. Some patients with asthma can experience longer episodes and some degree of daily airway impairment. Asthma can be very mild, like we've discussed today. Well controlled, right? Not a problem. It can also be deadly. I had a patient die from asthma. So it does happen. People can die. So do take it seriously. It can be a very serious... It's so common that we kind of... There's only 20. There's 10% of you here have asthma. Okay, that's pretty prevalent. So we kind of take an easy thought on asthma. Well, yeah, it's well controlled. Everybody has their little inhalers. Please also take it seriously because it can be deadly. Triggers. We talked about triggers, right? Allergens. We mentioned respiratory tract infections. I mentioned it's common post respiratory tract infections. Exercise. We talked about that. Inhaled irritants. Does that ever bother you? Any inhaled irritants?
Smoke.
Yeah, smoke. How about emotional? No? Yeah? Yeah. Emotional? Yes?
Question.
know that one machine that they have to take every day or every 4 hours? I don't know. My cousin had that machine to take it. Yeah.
A nebulizer.
Children
do. Do you ladies have? Yeah. Do you use it? Yeah. It's another way to. You do in the hospitals when they're having treatment. It's another way to deliver the albuterol or similar medication.
It works better than using the spray.
It does.
But it makes you lightheaded.
And you're an asthmatic too, so you can talk about it. See, our percentages are going up. Well, albuterol can make you lightheaded too.
Not as bad as a machine.
For you, well, that's because the machine's probably...
Shake. The machine makes me shake.
Yeah, because it's delivering more.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. The albuterol can make you shake, too, if you use enough of it.
So. In the middle of the night, I wake up like with asthma attacks.
Do you?
And then if I have to take it, no, I
can't. But you can if you do the nebulizer?
No.
You can't. Period, you can't.
In the middle of the night?
Forget it.
No, I'll just stay up.
That's because you're getting that adrenaline boost from the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're, so what's happening if you're getting this drug? How does it affect the albuterol? How does it affect you? What's going on?
I usually don't use the preventative stuff, but I have
the steroids. Or you just use the emergency.
Yeah, I have 6 different inhalers because I have Kaiser, so my doctor's like, "Use this one in the morning, use it." I'm like, "I don't have time."
Oh, then you're getting a systemic, a long term.
I don't use any. I use the emergency.
Okay. You don't use any of the other ones?
No.
Okay. And that's okay for you?
Yeah.
But what happens when you use the albuterol?
It works. It
dilates the bronchi. Yeah. What are the side effects of it then? Yeah. Absolutely.
I've had to go into emergency too for it. I have
increased heart rate big time, right?
Yeah. I was at Betty Hahn's eating dinner. And I ordered a drink because my family was having drinks, and we were laughing about something, and I couldn't breathe, and I said, I need to get out of here, and they thought I was joking, and I went to the emergency, and since I walked in there, she said, "Oh, you're fine, you can go have a seat," and I got into an argument with her, because I was the only one in the emergency, and she just blew me off, and I was screaming at her, crying, because I couldn't breathe.
Yeah. I can understand that.
But usually, it's okay. The weather.
What are your triggers? Weather?
Yeah.
Emotional distress, like being with your old family at dinner?
No. I had a laughing attack and it went bad.
Yeah, anything that can trigger a spasm?
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe it wasn't as much asthma as probably coupled together.
Bronchitis and an asthma attack.
And which caused a spasm, a laryngeal spasm that caused the, yeah. But again, the albuterol would relax the muscles and take care of that.
At that time, the albuterol didn't work at all.
Oh, it didn't?
The bronchitis.
Oh, because the bronchitis. Yeah. Because you get the mucus buildup. I'm glad you're okay. Yes, more?
I'm saying that one of the, if you come to the ER, if you're having airway problems or if you're bleeding, aren't you supposed to help me right away?
Well, yeah, breathing is what it's all about. We teach you that, right? Obviously, this nurse did not...
I just asked the ER team when I was in there a couple weeks ago, how do you prioritize things?
Yeah, breathing.
And I was telling the nurse that I came in there, hysterical because I couldn't breathe. And she's like, "Well, you won't do just fine."
Well, see, yeah, that's it. Her assessment was you're obviously getting enough air.
Yeah.
Well, to you, this was a huge deal. To them that see, people that have been run over by cars, it's not as... It's all in perspective.
Yeah, she told me that. People now say, "Oh, I had a stroke," or "I feel like I've had a stroke," so that they can be taken back right away.
Oh,
because they'll treat those people.
Well, that's a good idea. I don't remember that. But don't say you have an asthma attack. Let's say you sit there.
Yeah.
Okay. Emotional upset too. I've actually had son-in-law asthma attacks. I went for years, could not have dinner with this man, and without getting up and reason. Yeah, it's really true. He's working now, so I'm feeling a little better now. Okay, we went through the triggers, right? We went through the path. Now you understand what's going on. Airway edema. Okay? Trapping of air impairs gas exchange. This is what's going on with asthma. It's a trapping of air, bronchial constrictions, inflammatory cells, which is why the steroids work, or steroids are commonly. Chest tightness, cough, tachycardia. This is, remember Patrick, with his incredible heart rate. prolonged aspirations, fatigue, anxiety, apprehension, big time, right? You were really scared. Yeah, apprehension. Respiratory failure. Breath sounds can improve right after failure. Let's see. Cough, virulent asthma. Yeah, don't wait for a wheeze. Okay, don't think, oh, well, they're not wheezing, therefore they don't have asthma. No, you can have coughing asthma. And this was my son. He can't have asthma, he's not wheezing. So now I make sure that people know you can have coughing asthma. Common post-infection, all right, particularly. Okay. Got asthma. COPD is a collection of diseases in which there's chronic airflow obstruction. Bronchitis, emphysema, okay, are COPDs. The big deal here is impaired gas exchange. Got it? Resistance to airflow is increased. Expiration becomes slow and difficult. Your dry population, have you seen some of this? Have you? COPD patients? Yeah. You should, lots of them. Chronic bronchitis is also considered a COPD. And emphysema. In emphysema, there's a destruction of the walls of the alveoli. The air spaces are enlarged. That's the characteristic of emphysema, abnormally enlarged air spaces and airway collapse. You have a loss of alveoli surface area. If you think about what's going on in the alveoli, you have to have good surface area for gas exchange, right? That's why the lung is constructed as it is. So if you lose that surface area, you're going to retard the gas exchange. Very logical, correct? Let's see, what else about COPD? Talked about emphysema, prolonged x-ray, cystic fibrosis. I really hope that you'll see CF when you do your pediatric rotations. Cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease characterized by excessive mucus. These people have a huge mucus buildup, and there are two things that characterize cystic fibrosis. The inability to make one kind of pancreatic enzyme, so digestion is impaired, and a huge buildup of mucus. It used to be considered a strictly pediatric disease, no longer the case. I actually cared for a 50-something-year-old CF patient, which is 20 years ago that would have been unheard of. So people are living, which is amazing, with this disease. The problem is that because they're living into their reproductive years, we're going to be seeing more of it because more CF patients are being born and surviving today. I hope you get to see them on your pediatric rotation. There are these people who, great children, who are in the hospital a few times a year. So they know everybody, they know the routine. They come in when the disease is exacerbated. They come in for airway treatments. A lot of respiratory therapy treatments. I actually saw a lot of percussing, where they're actually pounding on the lungs. They have these vests that they wear that goes. Okay, a lot of interesting treatments. So I hope you have the experience to see this. Also, look at the psychosocial of these children. What is it like to be in the hospital every 3 months of your life? And this is how they grow up and live into adulthood now. With CF, it's very interesting. And the two things that nurses do is facilitate the breathing and give the pancreatic enzymes before every meal. It's most interesting. So it's an incredible buildup of mucus. If you see CF, think mucus. It's just a tremendous production that obviously impairs airway. Excessive mucus, inability to clear secretions. It's also considered a COPD. They move on to pulmonary hypertension, right ventricular hypertrophy. They commonly die of corpulmonale, which is right-sided heart failure that goes into the lungs, and that's generally the cause of death in cystic fibrosis. And also it has this pancreatic enzyme deficiency. So there's a gastrointestinal side to the disease. Very interesting. It's hereditary, so this is a genetic disease. You're born with it, you live with it, and you can pass it on. So most interesting. Diabetes, liver failure. Males are often sterile. Women have trouble conceiving. Yeah. Obviously, they're going to have barrel chests. These kids are real round. And if you always hear about barrel chests with asthma. And children do get it with asthma. Not so much now because asthma is fairly well controlled in the pediatric population. cystic fibrosis children do get it because they can't be as well controlled as asthmatics. And you honestly see a real barrel chest, just like we learned about in PAFA. Very interesting. Club fingers and toes. Learned about that. Okay. What's the word steroidorrhea? Fatty stool is fats in the stool is most common, and this is most interesting to see. If you see steroidorrhea, it looks like fat globules on stool. So yeah, common with this population. Also with irritable bowel, you see steroidorrhea quite a bit. Atelectasis, lung collapsing. Let's see, what else do we want to talk about? Occupational lung disease, you know that that exists. Coal workers, asbestos, right? What else are we going to talk about? I think that's, we talked about pulmonary embolisms before, right? So you should be pretty clear on that. Just, if it comes out of my mouth, it's important, okay? I think that's about it. Because I want to get on to some time to review for you. Right-sided ventricular hypertrophy causes chloropulmonary. All right. Should we leave this? Yes. Oh, now I want to save. Save the... Oh, good. It's looking good. Okay, GarageBand, great work. Thank you, turning you off.